to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are doing a little year in review and maybe a look forward into 2017 with a number of our good friends. We'll have Jane Klebb on the show as well, talking the rule, progressive politics, and Professor Phil Harvey talking about economic issues. But first, we are joined by Anoa Chenga, who's an attorney and the host of The Way with Anoa, friend of the show for sure. Anoa, thank you so much for joining.
Thank you for having me, as always. It's most appreciated.
Well, the pleasure is all mine. And let's start by looking back at 2016. There's a lot of big stories that are out there. I think for most people, the Trump win, I guess, is the biggest story of 2016, unexpected. But another big story, obviously, Bernie Sanders coming out of nowhere. You were involved in helping him come out of nowhere. What were some of your biggest takeaways from that effort? Moving forward.
The greatest takeaway, the one thing I always try to remind everyone of, no matter where they fall on the spectrum, on the left, liberals, Democrats, whatever, is the power of people, right? Because like you said, another big story of this 2016 year in review has been Bernie Sanders and the rise of his campaign. And yes, he had his campaign, he had his actual official staffers and data folks and social media people, but there was this organic genesis of people who came together and said, yeah, we want that guy. People who had never organized before, people who had never really gotten out in their communities or led rallies or spoken, like everyday, average, ordinary folks came together and said, this is what we want. We believe in something and we're going to give it. And they gave the most formidable political machine in modern, modern American political history a run for their money in several different locations. You look at the upset that happened in the Michigan primary. That was huge, right? So that's the one thing that I carry into 2017 with me, is this amazing, energy. And we've already seen this happen with the Movement for Black Lives. We've seen this. I think that's probably one of the more organized and forceful, examples we've seen. We've seen it with Standing Rock. We've seen so many youth step up in so many different ways. And I think just looking at all of that, that makes, no matter the looming Trump administration, whatever, that's what inspires me the most about this whole year, is just this height of activism going forward.
I think it's a good point. There's a lot of points made this year about the Democratic base, quote unquote, shifting to the left, which it's true, but to some degree it's almost like, it's not as if these people were being controlled by like the DNC or whatever, right, before or something. But perhaps I think maybe this is the other thing that is new in 2016 that speaks to your point, is now there's really sort of like a different center of leadership, right, in the social movements and different pieces like that, where on the one hand, you have whatever happens at the DNC is going to be controlled by corporations. No disrespect to Keith Ellison, but that is just not that. That ain't gonna change. Nevertheless, you now have this whole other set of people, in movements and so on and so forth. How important is it going into 2017 that more work takes place to really try to coalesce a lot of this energy, especially now with new folks coming on after Trump has succeeded, to make sure that it's not just sort of like a lot of different people all over everywhere, but more of sort of a unified conversation, if not necessarily unified action?
I definitely think there's a lot of importance in terms of having, conversations around common causes and opportunities for coalition building. I think that the mistake a lot of people are making is like, we're all divided, or we got to all agree on these three issues to focus on. I think that there's so much work that needs to be done. It's really good that there are people who have different focal points. But I do agree that there needs to be some conversation that's had early on, like, okay, this is where we can have some united collective action. This is where we can put value, and just set the stage that way. I get this a lot, because people are like, this new organization is formed, or this old organization is revamping itself, or this, that, and the other is happening. There's so much work to be done. There's room for everybody to do it. But I do think that, especially as, someone who's been Black and a woman in this progressive space, I do recognize, my profession, my educational background does give me a certain level of privilege and stuff. But at the same time, regardless, as a Black woman in progressive spaces, it is a huge challenge to have perspective, points of view, and issues actually addressed adequately at times, even amongst the most you know, benevolent and wonderful of ally spaces. So I really do think that we can't be in such a push to be, you know, everybody has to be against Trump. We all have to agree on these three things, that we lose sight of these other voices that definitely need to be amplified and put out there. So I do see value in working together to, quote unquote, resist Trump. But at the same time, such resistance is really, I think we shortchange ourselves when people focus solely on Trump and his administration. Yes, it's a potentially abysmal combination. But at the same time, there are issues that are historic and endemic to American political society as a whole that has been ingrained within this country, that we can't just stop at, you know, resisting Trump. We have to really do both, and we have to both resist Trump and the nonsense that potentially could come out of his administration, but also address the systemic issues however best we can at the state and local level that have been persisting.
No, I think you're entirely correct there. And you know, let me also ask you this, now that you brought that up. You know, we talked to Marcus Farrell about this in the new organization Impact, and I know you're also working with them. So, I mean, I'm curious just to get your thoughts. I mean, what are you guys trying to do? What are some of the things you have planned? I know you're working in North Charleston, and some of what you hope could come out of this initiative coming from you folks.
So there's a couple different things in the works right now. Marcus had a very ambitious timetable, but, you know, life happens. Marcus had actually wanted to be on the ground right now already, but it takes time, you know, to work out logistics with people and stuff. So some of the things that we've been talking about doing is looking at, you know, Nina Turner talks a lot about doing work in year-round, right? That we don't have such a thing called an off-cycle. You know, people like to use the term, oh, off-cycle or blah, 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 but we're always on. And for so often, we talk about our community, whether it's the Black community or the underrepresented communities, people are only showing up in time to get us to vote for them, right? And they're not even focusing on really the barriers and the other structural inequities that keep us from being able to participate in the process, or that turn us off so that we don't want to participate in the process. But it's not about trying to get people engaged, whether it's in legislative, you know, people's lobbying, legislative action, or you know, when it comes time to voting or running candidates or some other type of community organizing. It's really about helping to actualize the potentials in our communities already, because there's a lot of really great homegrown grassroots stuff that is happening. So it's not like we think, oh, we smart, we come teach you how to do this. We already know that there are great people all over the place who are already doing good work. The idea is to help through various trainings, various other supports, to help people amplify and ramp up the activities that they're doing based on the issues they're identifying already locally in their community. One of the things we saw, the potential, and Marcus was able to talk with folks from Black Lives Matter in Charleston, South Carolina, to talk about maybe ways we could help as Impact with some of their efforts around the Police Accountability and Civilian Review Board that they're trying to get people to be a part of, right? That's just one piece of some of the other work they're looking at in South Charleston. We talked with some folks, I think, in Birmingham. Also, shout out to Cara McClure. And I only name Cara because Cara is who I know personally, and she hates the shine, but with Black Lives Matter in Birmingham and some of the issues they're working around as well there. So just looking to see how we can kind of network amongst all these different groups that are working together. And some of them work with each other, too, right, to amplify, whether they're looking at doing something legislative action-oriented, but they're looking at, you know, city council or doing trainings. So one of the other things is potentially in the works is a community listening tour, actually going around and traveling to certain cities to start out, and then also doing a virtual tour as well, virtual listening session, kind of similar to what the EPA has done, except we actually want to act on what we hear back from people with the recent ones EPA had. I think it was with hazardous chemical waste in clean water. So just hearing from communities, what do people feel are their issues? What do they feel are maybe the structural barriers or what? Because I know the people who say, I want to help, I want to do something, but I don't really know how, or I don't know how to tap in. I mean, people work, you know, people are raising kids. There's so many different things people have going on. So if we could find a way to help provide processes, help provide some just basic training to folks. And the idea, hopefully, if we could ever get, you know, adequately funded, is to actually have people in their communities paid as community organizers to do the work. Because for so often, people expect us and our communities in particular to work for free. You know, that was one of the things I heard from my friends some of my friends who did try to help or work with, you know, Secretary Clinton's campaign was the fact that why they got to come to the black women talking about we need you to volunteer your time when all we hear is about all this money she's raising. They always look to us to volunteer. They always look for us to work for free. They always want us to come and run phones and do this and do that. But if we could actually give value, because that is so valuable what people are doing at the community level, if we could actually find a way to give value, if we could actually find a way to help at least give people stipends to do some of the work, then that, I think, helps build the pipelines for leadership. Mm-hmm. Because that's something else that we're missing. We're missing a leadership pipeline.
Well, I was just going to say that, too.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, the sort of red thread that ran through all of that to some degree, too. I mean, you're in Atlanta. We mentioned Charleston. We mentioned Birmingham. I mean, it's to some degree, you look at what happened in the Democratic Party primary. I mean, I think there's clearly an issue there with sort of like a captured, entrenched black political leadership, you know, that really is more beholden to corporations than anything else. So it seems like to some degree, you know, a lot of what you're saying, I think, is very true. It's a leadership pipeline, and it's sort of a struggle over what the future of quote-unquote black politics is going to mean in this country. And I think for some time, that's been sort of like, what does the NAACP and the CBC say? And
right.
That's what everyone else is going to say what the agenda is. And, you know, maybe we'll ask Jesse Jackson what he thinks. But now it seems like sort of a newer grassroots leadership emerging here.
Well, yeah. And I mean, what we've seen, particularly like for many of us growing up, particularly in urban areas, whether it's been in the South or up North, because like living in Chicago, I would always say, oh, my God, this is like down South. But up North, like regardless of where you are, we know that we have certain struggles when you're growing up in a black community, regardless of where you are. I mean, pretty much if you don't live in a certain area, if you at least have family that you want to visit, right? We see the plague of gentrification that's displacing people all over the country. We see issues with our schools. We see issues with services and things in our neighborhoods. I mean, there's so much that's going on, and I'm not here to throw salt or say anything about NAACP or anybody else's organization, but there are things that are happening, and the way that things have been done for the last 50 years have not necessarily really alleviated those burdens that are placed on our communities. And we need a new way of thinking and a new way of engaging people. And a lot of times, you know, they're working at a different level that's not necessarily touching people on the bottom. Mm-hmm. And those are the people that we need to help empower and help work with their natural strengths. Because you, if you live in Southwest Atlanta, you know what you need in your community better than somebody else. Maybe you don't necessarily have the tools or the verbiage to actually convey that in an effective manner. Or maybe you do and you just don't know who to talk to. But you know better than somebody coming from some, you know, hoity-toity school someplace else that has some job in the city what you need in your community. And that breakdown of actually trusting the community to know what they need, it's been a problem. And we've seen, you know, urban decay for the last several decades now. And the best thing that we can do is try to help empower folks to make decisions for themselves. And I'm really inspired from what I've just been seeing from people. Like, I'm just reading about in Florida, no major organizations behind it, but it looks like, you know, getting a felony restoration of the vote back on might be on the ballot for 2018. And that was just people coming together saying, this really needs to happen. So there are really great signs of people rising up to do what is needed all over the place. And that's something that Impact hopes to have, that's trying, working on having an impact on going into 2017 and beyond.
And so what are some of the main themes you're looking at in 2017? Some of the things that are at least important to you to work on, or some of the things you think are going to be big issues, or, I don't know, some combination of those two things?
Well, I think definitely supporting efforts and endeavors that look at addressing voting issues, right? Like, Democrats have been very, very quick to talk about voter suppression, about this, that, and the other. You know, people are talking about recounts, but no one's really talking about the recount in Nevada with Rocky De La Fuente. I mean, there's just so much that's going on. People talk about what would have benefited their candidate, but no one's really looking, or very few people are actually working prospectively to address the issue ahead of the next election cycles. We saw voter suppression in North Carolina. We saw voter suppression in Wisconsin. We saw it happening in Ohio. We've seen it happen in Florida, so many different places, and it's like, oh, this is really bad. Maybe we should work on it like a few weeks before an election. But these would be initiatives, issues that we really need to be kind of mobilizing around well before an election cycle. And I won't say nobody, you know, the NAACP Legal Defense Fund is always on top of these issues, but that's one organization that is a separate entity from the NAACP that's working on stuff. So anything that we can do to kind of amplify work like that, I mean, a lot of stuff, too, though, we're looking to the communities to say, hey, this is what we really feel like we need to be working on. But for me personally, I would like to see more synergy with black and brown communities working on issues in terms of environmental justice and environmental racism. Mm. You know, when we look at who are the most, and that's something that's very personal to me, getting over an asthma exacerbation when my asthma was caused by a chemical spill in West Virginia 3 years ago, similar to what happened down in Corpus Christi with a some type of coal agent or whatever chemical in their water. Something similar happened to us 3 years ago in West Virginia. And long story short version, EPA, the state government, and the CDC all screwed up. People got sick and they're like, oh, well, yeah, it's winter time. That's probably why you got sick. Long story short version. So that's something that, you know, is personally important to me, clean water access, but not being centered in these primarily white liberal environmental organizations. We really need to see that fight being shifted towards looking at the impact that it does have on black, brown, and other underrepresented communities, because those are the people, we are the ones that are most impacted by, you know, this conversation over global climate change. I read a very interesting article about public housing and how public housing is actually endangered by climate change because of where, you know, it's usually poor land. I mean, they were looking at a public housing site, I don't know if it was Jacksonville, I can't remember, someplace in Florida, and they were just talking about all the potential threats that they're seeing to housing sites because of where they're built, how they're maintained or not maintained, rather. And it's a problem. And these are problems for our communities. And yes, we spent so much time working and raising families that a lot of us don't tend to think about these things, but they directly impact us. You know, our communities are more likely to be close to factories or coal burning plants or even, you know, in fracking, you know, communities where they're doing fracking, just all types of stuff. So those two things, I think, are top of my list. I mean, there are countless other issues too, but those would be two things that I don't think are talked about. We met a really bunch of great folks from Next Gen Climate, so I would really love a bunch of black folks that were working with Next Gen Climate when I was at Roots Camp in D.C. And so, really love to, you know, kind of follow more folks who are doing this work and who understand that point of view of working with underrepresented and as well as black and brown communities. Like, those are two things I think off the top of my head that I've 2017, I would really like to see either us or just more work being done around, period. I'd actually like to write more about both those things. So,
Well, it's a very relevant issue, too, and one of those issues that has an interesting connection that I'm glad you brought it up with the public housing issue, because one of the areas where HUD could actually have a big impact on this, and many people don't know, is that a lot of the funds for, you know, hard-hit areas, Hurricane Sandy relief, people who are in floodplains, all that kind of stuff, and building more resilient communities and so on and so forth, which will affect some of the communities you're talking about, are, in fact, running through HUD. And, you know, there now we have Ben Carson, who does not actually believe in climate change, in this position, and you think they're going to be looking to cut programs, they may want to start there. Yeah, I mean, I'll just say this final word, perhaps, on this issue. I mean, what are you expecting from the Trump cabinet?
I'm not expecting anything from the Trump cabinet. I think one thing that I've learned over the last several, I guess, years of engaging in the political processes, I've come not to expect much of anyone that takes that office. And I expect from the people who challenge and provide counterbalances, one way that can be is participating in the different processes that are set forth. I think lawsuits, citizens' lawsuits, may become over the next several years, may become another tool where possible as well. Which could, you know, citizen suits in some environmental context can actually be successful. You know, in terms of enforcement and stuff, I really do think that, I mean, it's going to be an uphill battle. And I believe no matter what happens, it will be an uphill battle. But it's already been an uphill battle. You know, it's not like it's been walk in a park from transitioning from Bush to Barack Obama. I mean, we've had some things that have been passed over Obama that have actually been have made in some ways being an activist and out there organizing more difficult. So I really do think that we need to stop this notion that somehow Trump is just going to make our lives so much more worse than they already have been. I mean, we've already been facing challenges.
Right. Well, that's a good point. I think we're going to have to put a pin in it there, but that was Noah Chenga. And as always, thank you for joining us. We're going to come back with more here on By Any Means Necessary and on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By Any Means Necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear. And as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are continuing with our, I guess you could say, 2016 retrospective, 2017 prospective look at politics and progressive movements and things like that by talking with Jane Klepp, the Nebraska Democratic Party chair, founder of Bold Nebraska, and a board member of Our Revolution. Jane, thank you so much for joining the show.
Yeah, it's great to be on with you.
Pleasure is always all mine, and we are roughly a month and a half after the election day, roughly a month before the inauguration day, and while many people are focusing sort of on what's going to happen once Trump takes the oath of office, one thing I've been asking people that I'm curious your thoughts on, is there anything that Obama could still do in these waning days that you'd like to see him try to sneak in here before it's over?
Well, you know, if a complete wish list is there, it would be for him to end eminent domain for private gain. You know, it's something that I bring up often when on your show. It's a tool that big oil uses to take land away from farmers, ranchers, and folks in proposed pipeline routes. It would literally put an end to pipelines if he did it. But one of the big asks that the environmental and climate movement had was to protect the Arctic and parts of the Atlantic, which the president did yesterday in a really historic move that he protected some of our public water. So I think we're pretty much done with what President Obama is going to do before he leaves office. And so now it's going to be up to us to kind of protect his legacy and all the things that we've accomplished these last 8 years.
Mm-hmm. So one of the big sort of factors in all of that is who's going to be the next chair of the DNC. It's a pretty hot race. I can never remember a party chair race seeming like it's like a congressional race or something with all these websites and everything, but nevertheless, it's a big issue. It's getting out there. I saw that you have endorsed Keith Ellison, the congressman from Minnesota, who I guess people could say is the front runner. I mean, have you been surprised that apparently the White House seems to be one of the key places that isn't that warm to Ellison?
You know, see, the thing is like, I hate the anonymous quotes, you know, and all of the language and all the kind of, you know, tips that we're getting that supposedly say that the White House is behind Perez and they don't want Ellison as the chair is all just, you know, anonymous quotes. And so I don't buy it. I think it's people who support Perez and maybe just personally don't like Ellison are using this cover of, you know, this is what the White House wants. President Obama is a pretty direct politician. He does not hide behind people. And so I think if Obama really wanted Perez, he would come out and say he endorses him. So I take all that with a grain of salt. I don't buy it. And Ellison is clearly the more progressive candidate in the race. There's no question about it. He has more street credibility with us as activists and organizers. Perez is obviously a great Democrat, love him, did great work as labor secretary, but he supported the TPP, and that is one of the big issues and defining things for us, especially in the Midwest and working class families across races. So I'm firmly behind Ellison and do think that he will eventually be the chair.
Well, it's interesting because I wonder what take you have, especially as someone I know who's a big supporter of Senator Sanders and the way sort of the quote unquote identity politics conversation has fallen down in sort of the conversation here. And I think Ellison's at an interesting point that it's not really sort of an either or situation, which actually reminds me, I one time was at a rally, it was a Black Lives Matter thing in front of the Capitol where he spoke at. And I always tell people this because I thought it was very interesting. The biggest cheer from the crowd was actually when he said he was supporting the fight for 15. Which I think kind of in and of itself sure showed, if I can use the term, kind of the intersectionality of how these things can work together, sort of the economic and social demands. But I wonder, you know, sort of how you're looking at that conversation.
Yeah, so I think that there's this big misunderstanding that whenever you say working class, that all of a sudden means white folks. Mm. And, you know, working class families cut across all races, genders, ethnicities, sexual orientations. And so, you know, that's what Senator Sanders was getting to. And I think that's what Ellison has really tried to begin to communicate in the DNC race is that the Democratic Party used to be the party of the people, used to be the party of the working class family. When unions were strong, when a lot of our middle class families knew that their kids were going to do better than they did, that there was always money left over for a family vacation, maybe a new car every, you know, 5-6 years. And that's not the case anymore. Those basic stuff is not the case anymore for our families. So I hate when people automatically equate working class with just white folks, because I know a lot of working class families that are Black, Latino, gay, you name it.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, yeah, the party has to start focusing on working class families. Now, obviously, I live in a rural state, right? I live in Nebraska. I live in even a more rural town, less than 25,000 folks in the town that I live in. And I do think also that the party has completely ignored rural America. If you start to look at the maps of where Latino and other minority communities, especially immigrant communities that are coming from different countries like Somalia and Sudan, they're going to small rural communities because that is where they can find a sense of community and where they can find jobs in factories and agriculture. So, the party at the national level has completely missed what it means to live in rural communities and who those voters are.
Right, right. Well, no, that's a fantastic point. I'm from Charlottesville, Virginia originally, and which was always considered very cosmopolitan because the University of Virginia was there. But, you know, when I was growing up, it was pretty much only Black and white people. But now I'm very happy to say we're a IRC, International Refugee Site, and you have people from like all over the world. And it's so crazy to see where I come from. And just, I'm only 30, like the transformation from like a little sleepy southern town to this place where all of a sudden you can get like Ethiopian, Balkan, and Afghan food that's all like as good as
right?
what I get in D.C. And yeah. Something is going on out there. But I'm glad you referenced to being from a rural state, from Nebraska, because one of the things that I think is interesting here, obviously with the Trump presidency that is getting very little coverage, is what potentially is going to happen with the Secretary of Agriculture. Now, I mean, my general assumption from what he's done so far is it's probably not going to end up being good. I've seen some names, Susan Combs out of Texas, Heidi Heitkamp from the Dakotas. Anyone, any of the picks, any of the names you've seen out there sort of particularly scaring you, or maybe being one of those kind of areas where maybe there's something that could be interesting?
You know, obviously, out of all those choices, I'd rather see a Democrat, even though I don't really agree with Senator Heitkamp on many issues. There are some that we do agree upon. You know, so I don't think any of those picks represent the small family farmers and ranchers that, mm-hmm. you know, I do most of my work with. You know, when you're looking at that, you really are. There's few national people who have risen to the national stage that do really represent rural communities. And so Jim Hightower would be one, you know, he used to be the Texas Ag Secretary, Black Democrat that was elected statewide, I think, in that state.
Indeed, defeated by Rick Perry in 1990 there.
Yes. So, you know, we have a major obstacle, those of us that do represent rural communities, to actually start pushing people up to the national level and making sure that the Democratic Party is also recognizing those people and putting those folks on the national stage. We just get left out. People think that there's only Republicans in rural communities and rural states, and it's just not true.
Not only is it not true, but, you know, some of the more interesting signs of resistance that people may be interested in learning about, the Family Farmer Rebellion in the late 70s, people clogging up D.C. with tractors and all that kind of stuff, the Black farmers. I mean, so many things that have been, you know, big and powerful struggles that aren't even really out there. And I wonder, you know, it just seems to me, I agree with you, not only the leaders, but also the issues. I mean, to me, one of the biggest failed policy issues in America in the last 20 years is when they got rid of price floors in 96 and family farms just, you know, plummeted, just completely gutted, or not gutted, but at least body blow to that sector because of, you know, the inability or the ability now of big corporations to exploit family farmers. And that to me is like a great issue. I mean, it's an issue of family farms. I think 9 out of 10 people on the street would say they're for family farms. But in a climate where more and more people in these quote unquote Democratic strongholds seem to care about localized, regionalized food, pesticides, all these other kind of issues, that some of these quote unquote rural issues could be top line issues that everyone could care about, because obviously everyone eats food.
There's no question about it. See, the thing is Ag Secretary Vilsack and Obama, they did just put in this new rule right before they're leaving office to protect poultry workers and to protect poultry growers, so the small family farmers. The reality is, I'm not saying that all big corporations are evil, right? None of us would say that. But the vast majority of times when you look at things, small is always better than big. Mm. A small family farmer is going to protect their water supply and their land and rotate the crops and make sure that they're taking care of the chicken poop and everything else that comes along with ag in a much more appropriate and sustainable way than a big corporation is, because they know that they can pick up and move to the next town. Family farmers can't, right? They're tied to that land. It is their blood and their sweat and their tears. So we need to, as progressives, especially our progressive allies who live in coastal states, to not sneer at rural states and to not sneer at farmers. I can't tell you the amount of campaigns that I see that say, you know, stop eating beef, or, you know, how we need to essentially seceive, you know, let the rural communities live on their own. They are, you know, taking too much corporate welfare and all this other nonsense. Mm. The reality is every single one of us, a lot of us shop at farmers market, sure, but a lot of us also do the majority of our shopping in grocery stores. And every time you walk into the grocery store, you better thank a small rural community who put the food on those shelves. And I think we have to start recognizing that rural and urban are way more interconnected than we may think on the surface.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. No, I think that's a great point. And the other area that I was thinking about is also in just, I mean, and I say everyone is on the progressive side is connected in this, but, you know, especially seeing how Senator Sanders was pushing such a strong anti-Wall Street message, how that was playing in rural areas. I mean, I think that's something that a lot of people don't know about because they just don't know about rural areas, but the importance of commodity exchanges in particular to many small farmers, and it's certainly dairy farmers have been getting hit very hard up at the Mercantile Exchange in Chicago and other things like that. I mean, did you find that that had sort of a particular resonance in these areas? Because there really is a very, like, direct relationship between so the prices of so many commodities, small farms, and, like, what's going on in these big trading houses.
There's no question. You know, when you really do just sit down at a table and share a cup of coffee or whiskey, you know, with somebody in a rural community, they will tell you that they hate Wall Street, that they hate big, right? Whether it's big banks or big oil. You know, they don't like, because they think that they don't understand kind of their way of life, that they don't respect kind of, you know, a handshake. Mm. I know my banker in our small town. His name's Craig Marble, right? That's the thing in small rural communities. You know your banker, you know the person who owns the grocery store, and that's the way that we do business at a very localized level. And so, yeah, there's no question that Bernie Sanders' message about kind of a very economic populist message. I mean, you brought up the kind of farm rebellion. I mean, I think it's really important for people to remember in the 80s when big banks were foreclosing on small family farms, farmers did not look to some big farm organization or a candidate to help save the family farm. You know what they did? They all stood together and did this thing called the penny auction, where they essentially made sure that anybody who was going to be doing a bid on a family farm that was up for auction was actually from the community. Mm. And they gave that land then back to the family farm. They stood together. They protected each other from these big banks and banks foreclosing on families. So I think it's a good reminder that, look, a lot of our populist roots actually come from rural farming communities.
I would say that is very true from the populist movement to the Greenback Labor Party to, I mean, a whole range. I mean, it really is sort of an interesting hidden history in America. Well, I don't want to say it's hidden. Actually, Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States might be one of the best places to see some of that stuff. But really something that people don't know to some degree is who is where and what's going on and some of the history of these struggles, which I think is so key. So I'm glad that you looked at that. I mean, one, you know, thing to me about sort of just looking at this overall sort of post-election situation as well, where there's, I don't know, potentially to me some sort of intersect here. And I know the Southern Federation of Farm Cooperatives talks a lot about this, but as an employment piece that, you know, especially when we're talking about how do we sort of rejigger and revision our entire sort of food chain process, that for, you know, this large amount of structural unemployment we're seeing in this country, food production, especially healthy food production, could be a big, totally different, you know, way of approaching this, where it's not just, I mean, you know, not that I'm against infrastructure or whatever, but it's not just, well, we're going to employ people building bridges and roads, but there's sort of a whole wider range of things that I think are very relevant that we don't also consider as well.
There's no question about it. The creation of a better food system where we're actually making sure that the kids in hospitals and prisons and in schools is coming from a more local radius, so we are producing more jobs in that local community and making sure that people are getting healthy food, is definitely a direction that we can be going in. You know, the other thing is clean energy, right? And so when, you know, Donald Trump and other people are talking about infrastructure, you know, I get worried that they're only talking about fossil fuel infrastructure. And the reality is in rural communities, we do have some open spaces that are being underutilized. And solar panels would be a perfect location for so much of this underutilized land. And so that is one area that I think rural communities should be turned to. Now, I will say that the way that some of the wind companies, especially foreign wind companies, have come into these small towns thinking that we need to be saved, which we don't. We like living small, and just because we don't have a Starbucks does not mean that we're, you know, like dying.
You may be better off. I don't know.
Yeah, we have a good local coffee shop downtown. You know, is that they come in and think that they're just going to throw money at a farmer. Some of the farmers, they're fine with one or two windmills, but they don't want 30 windmills in their backyard. And so we have to make sure that when we're building kind of clean and sustainable energy, that we're doing it in a clean and sustainable way where landowners are also at the table.
Mm-hmm. Another big issue that's coming up that's very relevant. How important is broadband access in rural communities now? I mean, I'm in D.C., so I just see all the cell phone commercials with all these little random maps of where they have service or not. But, I mean, that I know is traditionally a very big issue. Is that one that is just going to be high on your agenda coming up here in 2017?
It's a huge issue. And honestly, we, as a progressive community, don't spend enough time on that. And it's something that even Bold, you know, the organization that I work with, needs to spend more time focusing on. One brief story. There was a kind of rural broadband grant for the state of Nebraska that supposedly none of our rural communities applied for. Mm. The fact is none of them even knew that it was there. And so what the Public Service Commission in our state did was give it to Lincoln and Omaha, which absolutely defeats the whole purpose of the rural broadband federal money, you know, that was coming to help our communities. I'll tell you, there's a lot of, you know, small family farms and ranches that are doing kind of direct to buyer, right? So you can go on a website, read the story about the family farm and buy meat or cheese from that particular family farm. They need better broadband. It is a real problem as you get further and further west. In particular in our state, in Nebraska, they literally are on dial-up right now, and it is awful.
Wow, I'm flashing back to the old dial-up days, like my mom yelling at me to get off the internet so she could use the phone.
Use the phone.
It's 2016. Like that's obviously got to move forward. Well, let me also ask you this just in sort of a general question too. I think like one of the things a lot of people are wondering is like, okay, a lot of people who are coming from the Sanders movement, getting more involved in the actual structures of the Democratic Party. You're now the chair, incoming chair, and now you've been sworn in Nebraska. What are some of the things that are on you and your team's agenda to try to do here in terms of the direction of the party there?
You know, one thing that Ellison actually has been talking about in his race for chair is that we have to get beyond the 50-state strategy and really get to the 3,007-county strategy. Mm. That really we have to get hyper-local. And so we actually have a bunch of new projects that we've rolled out. One of them is called the Blue Bench Project, where we're going to be training not only young people, but anyone of any age who wants to either run as a candidate or be involved in party leadership, because that seems to be a huge mystery. Like, sometimes the party structure seems like it is completely closed off and inaccessible, and we're trying to change that so people understand how to run for a caucus chair and how to run for, you know, a local county party chair. But the other thing we're doing, instead of just doing town halls, which we're going to do, you know, we want to hear from folks and organize on issues, we're literally going to do a door-to-door listening tour where we are creating teams of organizers, all volunteers, where we're just going to start going into communities and going door to door. We're not going to use the van. We're not going to target only Democrats. We're going to talk to everybody and just start saying, hey, we're the Democratic Party. Here is three things that you could do if you want to be engaged in issues. If you're interested in running as a candidate, we have a training program for that. And tell me about some of the things that you're concerned about. That has not been done in, I don't even know, maybe 20, 30 years.
Wow.
People have stopped, you know, just talking to people. So that's what we're going to do. You know, check back with me in a couple of months and see how it's going, right? We literally have no idea if this is going to be the most stupidest idea we've ever had, or if it's actually going to be, you know, leading to something.
Well, it sounds like a good idea to me. As a political organizer, I feel like there's never any substitute at all. But Jane, thank you so much for coming on today. That was Jane Klebb. She's the Nebraska Democratic Party chair, founder of Bold Nebraska, big in the pipeline struggles, among other things, and a board member of Our Revolution. We are going to take a break. We'll be back with more here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we're talking a little bit about progressive economics, a real right to work, not that fake one, and the intersection of jobs and human rights. And we are joined by Philip Harvey, professor of law, human rights, and a human rights economist, and is one of the world's foremost authority on this issue. Helped to author and set up HR 1000 that hopefully we will talk about as well. Mr. Harvey, thank you so much for joining the show.
I am happy to be with you.
So, you know, looking back at the election, I mean, it seems like sort of a bizarre reality to me that people are trying to deflect, from the role of economic forces to some degree. I mean, you had the Rust Belt give a slight edge to Trump, black voters in hard-hit communities sort of voting in lower percentages, millennials voting at the same fairly low percentage as normal. So it's like the three groups that really need the most widespread, broadest economic change either didn't vote in a large percentage or switched their votes from 2012, and yet somehow there's a big push to kind of make it about something other than the fact the working class has been hit hard for 30 years, at least on the Democratic side. I don't know what your thoughts are about that.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think the story is the longer one of what's been going on for, I would say, the past, 36 years since the election of Ronald Reagan, the neoliberal era, unprecedentedly high unemployment rates throughout that period on average, and the devastating effect that that's had on all segments of the working class, and the failure of the progressive movement in general to provide a unifying answer to that problem has resulted in a splintering of the coalition that was the basis of progressive reform prior to the onset of the neoliberal era.
And, you know, I think that's a good point, and because, you know, one of the things that also to me was a major factor, not just in the election, but just in general around sort of issues of the how the economy is quote unquote faring and how the working class is doing is, you know, the mainstream media and the popular press is just, you know, the economy is getting better. Everything's good. We're moving towards quote unquote full employment. I mean, and honestly, like usually just saying a bunch of things that most people don't know that much about and saying them very authoritatively without any sort of explanation. And so you have almost this complete divergence where I think sort of on the ground and anyone who's sort of working on any sort of quote unquote workers' rights issue or in some of these hard hit communities on any issue, you see one thing, but then the narrative that you see in the popular consciousness is like a totally different, you know, the reality. But I don't know if that is just me or if you're seeing a similar dynamic.
No, I see exactly the same thing. And I think that a significant reason for the failure of the narrative to reflect the reality is that even progressive economists have bought into a significant part of the idea that, 4 to 5% unemployment is as good as we can do. That's full employment. And so now that the unemployment rate is under 5%, people who thundered a few years ago about the need for more job creation, like Paul Krugman, don't talk about that issue anymore because from their perspective, well, the economy is doing about as well as it can do. While out there, there are millions and millions of workers who know that's not the case, and they're disenchanted. But the progressives are not providing them with a narrative that explains their suffering or an answer to that suffering.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's certainly a very good point. And you know, it just seems like, and this is to speak to the same point that, I mean, basic definitions also sometimes fail us. I mean, I saw that Janet Yellen said the other day, you know, that, well, the economy is moving towards full employment. But, I mean, most people don't know that from their sort of estimation, full employment is some low percentage, 4% or whatever, of unemployment. But, you know, they never really add that part in. And it almost seems like even phrases like full employment that you'd think would mean everyone has a job have just been sort of hijacked, at least rhetorically.
Yes, exactly. That economists, and this includes a lot of progressive economists, now equate full employment with the lowest rate of unemployment that's consistent with the maintenance of price stability, what economists call the NIRU, the non-accelerating inflation rate of unemployment. The problem is that the NIRU level, which may in fact be 4 to 5%, is a long way from what's needed to provide jobs for everyone. Just to give you a number associated with that, right now the unemployment rate is 4.6%. There are 5.5 million job openings on average in the economy, but there are 18.5 million workers who are either unemployed, employed part-time involuntarily, or jobless and wanting a job now, but not counted as unemployed because they're not engaged in the kind of search activity that economists or the Bureau of Labor Statistics uses to decide whether or not to categorize them as unemployed or not. So that there are actually 13 million fewer jobs in the economy than we need to provide jobs for everyone. And how anyone can say that we have full employment when we've got a job gap of 13 million is beyond me how progressives can buy into that narrative. And I think the reason is because they don't have a policy answer. And from their perspective, we are doing about as well as can be expected. And they haven't undertaken the hard work of trying to develop an alternative policy that actually can get us to full employment, genuine full employment, which would be, and we know this historically, we know it from experience, is between 1% and 2% unemployment.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, that's a good point and a good place maybe to segue too into H.R. 1000 that Congressman John Conyers out of Detroit, an area that's been very hard hit by job losses in a state that delivered some election results that I think reflected that. Tell us a little bit about this. You helped put this together, and it is a sort of policy response to this issue. Tell us what it is, what it would do, and then perhaps maybe some of the prospects here.
Okay. H.R. 1000 is not just another job creation bill. It's a bill that, if enacted, is designed to actually achieve genuine full employment. It recognizes that economic growth, whether it's achieved spontaneously by businesses just investing or as a result of economic stimulation by the government, can't get us to full employment. And the reason for that is that the growth starts to generate inflation long before we reach the level of output necessary to provide jobs for everyone. So we're left with a job gap, this 13 million job deficit that I mentioned a couple of minutes ago. So what we need is a strategy that somehow circumvents that inflation barrier to full employment. And we actually do have such a strategy. It was developed by American progressives in the 1930s. The New Dealers came up with the idea, well, what the government should do is provide jobs for whoever is in the job market for whom the private sector cannot provide employment. We will fill that job gap. And while they were totally unaware of the economic benefits of doing that from the perspective of inflation, it turns out that if you devise such a strategy intelligently, you can create those additional jobs in the public sector, temporary jobs for people the private sector cannot employ, and you can do it in a way that will allow you to achieve genuine full employment without inflation. The model for this was the so-called direct job creation programs of the 1930s, the Civilian Conservation Corps, and the Works Progress Administration, the WPA, and they demonstrated the feasibility of the government providing this kind of work. The New Dealers who devised this strategy proposed it as a means of closing the job gap completely, of providing what they called employment assurance. They didn't use the term full employment because it hadn't been invented yet. Mm. It was not until 1936 that John Maynard Keynes published his book that popularized the term full employment, so they didn't use it. But what they were talking about is what we now refer to as full employment. So the key is that whether the economy is in recession or whether the economy is booming, there's going to be a job gap in the economy. The best way to provide relief for the unemployed and also the best way to provide economic recovery when you're in a recession is to actually provide the jobs that the people who are unemployed need. Jobs first. You know, there's been a recent, in the past decade or so, change in the way homeless advocates have conceived and proposed strategies for remedying the problem of homelessness. And the watchword of this change is, you know, housing first. That the idea that somehow you fix the housing problem by fixing the homeless people so they get back on their feet, and then when they're back on their feet, they get into houses, that's not worked. So you provide them with the housing, and then their lives come back together. Well, the same thing is true of unemployment. This notion that somehow unemployment can be solved by addressing whatever the difficulties are that individuals are having binding work is flawed for two reasons. One is that there aren't enough jobs to go around, so that no matter what you do to help one person find a job, if you are successful, it's just going to mean that someone else doesn't have a job. And the other problem with it is that it's got it backwards. Just as the homeless advocates have pointed out, what people need to get their lives together, what they need to keep their lives together is jobs first. And HR 1000 is designed to do that. And the surprising thing is how little it would cost to do that. Now, I don't know how much you want me to go into the details of describing the program, but the essence of it is that it's a strategy for closing the economy's job gap. Use the same strategy during recessions and at the top of the business cycle. The only difference between the two periods is that the job gap is bigger during recessions, but even at the top of the business cycle, even when the unemployment rate is 4 to 5%, and a lot of economists are talking about full employment, you still have this huge job gap, and HR 1000 is designed to close it with the creation of temporary jobs that would pay people the same kind of wages that other public sector employees receive in order to perform useful public services, add to the physical and social wealth of the communities in which they reside. That's the basic idea behind it. And of course, there are lots of details. If you have any questions about it, I'd be happy to answer them.
Well, I think it's a very relevant point. And one thing that I thought about there too, towards the end, in terms of socially useful and also linking it to the New Deal. I mean, people forget, I think, oftentimes about, you know, so many of the cultural and artistic pieces and other things that came out of that, some of the actually beautiful architectural work, all sorts of things that people maybe take for granted now. But I say all that to say, I mean, the jobs conversation in the U.S. seems so trapped around, well, like, let's just hire a bunch of people to build roads and bridges. Obviously, we need more bridges. Certainly, we need better roads and better water pipes and all that kind of stuff. But I mean, to some degree, it seems like it adds almost a paucity to the conversation, because it's difficult to, I think, even conceive of, one, maybe even employing all unemployed people on that, but is that sort of being the horizon for what it means to, like, quote unquote, provide jobs?
Yes, it's clear that jobs have to be provided based on the skills, experience, and interest and desires of the population of jobless individuals. And that was actually much harder to do in the 1930s, because what governments did back then was much more limited to the kind of physical infrastructure improvements that are being talked about today. But notwithstanding that, as you say, the New Deal developed absolutely spectacular programs of support for unemployed artists. The program was organized actually by the federal government itself, whereas most other job creation initiatives undertaken by the WPA were done on the local level. And the program in the arts provided employment for all varieties of artists. Burt Lancaster worked as a trapeze artist in a WPA circus.
Wow.
There were many, many stars who got their start doing artistic work, photography, painting, oral histories. The murals that were produced by the New Deal are still, you know, enriching post offices on post office walls around the country. It was a tremendous period of creativity and innovation in that respect. And now the government does so much more, has its fingers in so many more issues, there's a lot more that can be done, and the major source of employment would be in the area of services, social services. The economy in general is predominantly now a service economy, and what governments predominantly do now is provide social services, so that's the area in which the greatest amount of job creation would be needed. And because there are so many varieties of things that need doing and can be done, it will actually be easier today to create the kind of jobs that workers need and that they have the interest and talent to perform than was true in the 1930s. And there's one other point that I want to make that I think is very important, and that is that unlike the conventional progressive strategy of government spending to stimulate job creation, the HR 1000 strategy of direct job creation by the government for the unemployed can be implemented at the local level, at the state or local level. And in fact, this coming spring, I'm involved in a project in New York City, which is going to, over the course of several weeks in May, roll out a map of New Deal sites in New York City. It's a project undertaken by a group of geographers from the University of California in Berkeley. They call it the Living New Deal Project, and they're trying to identify and map all the New Deal sites that still exist, the living legacy of the New Deal, so people can see it. But simultaneous with that rollout of the map, we are going to be presenting a local program design, possibly actually in the form of legislation submitted in the City Council of New York to implement the HR 1000 model in New York City to provide jobs or training for every New Yorker. So I think that one of the more promising aspects of the HR 1000 strategy is that in an era when we know that the possibility for progressive legislation at the federal level is limited, there are things that we can do at the state and local level where progressives are politically stronger, and the role played by legislation like H.R. 1000 is to provide a model so that people at the state and local level will have an idea of how to go about designing programs at their level. And I think that it's possible that the ball could get rolling in that way, demonstrating the feasibility of actually solving the problem of unemployment on the state and level, local level. And if that happened, all of those segments of the working class that are now splintered would be back on board, just as they were in the New Deal and the post-New Deal period.
Real final question here, a couple minutes left. You know, there's a big conversation starting about universal basic income in this country. Andy Stern with his new book out. I mean, on the one hand, interesting idea. On the other hand, it also seems like maybe sort of just, well, machines are going to take all your jobs, so everyone will be just like working at Uber and doing five service jobs, so you need a universal basic income to keep people from being hungry on the street. How are you viewing that argument?
Well, I've actually written a fair amount about it. I have absolutely no problem with the idea of providing people with a universal basic income, so that I'm not one of those people who thinks, oh, this is bad in principle. I think it'd be great. We have free libraries. Why not have free income? On the other hand, I think that there are two problems with the strategy that really disqualify it from serious consideration. The one is that it's not a substitute for a job. If you imagine, for example, you've got John and Jane Doe. They're both employed. They both have a basic income, and in addition to that, they've got a salary. One of the two of them loses their job. After they lose their job, well, they've got their basic income, but they've lost their salary. The other person has a job and a salary. The basic income doesn't replace the lost salary. It's not a substitute for a job. It's separate from a job. And I don't think that basic income advocates have really clued into the fact that whatever benefits it provides in establishing a floor does not create a substitute for the opportunities that employment provides people over and above that floor. And we never accept the notion that, well, it's okay if we provide jobs for 95% of the people and the 5% we leave out are going to be women or blacks or whoever. Well, it's equally unacceptable to say, I think, well, we're only going to provide employment for 95% of the people and the other 5%, whoever they may happen to be, they're just going to have to get along on their basic income. No, that's not right. It's not adequate. The other problem is the cost. If you simply multiply even the government's poverty line, which is not an adequate standard for a decent standard of living, times the population who would be receiving the basic income, it's astronomical. And the problem with that is not so much that, well, you can't afford it. Well, sure, in some sense we could afford it. But this notion that we can gradually work up to that $5-6 trillion figure by providing partial basic incomes runs into the fact that the partial basic income is not going to provide the benefits of the full basic income, but it's going to sacrifice the availability of those funds to meet other needs. We've got to provide schools. We've got to provide health care. We've got to provide jobs. We've got to provide social services. And providing a partial basic income as a substitute for that, I'm sure, would bother progressives if they were ever presented with the possibility.
Indeed. Well, we're going to have to put a pin in it there, but I appreciate you joining the show, Dr. Harvey. And with that, we're going to be out of time today on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movement shaping the world around us. See you next time.
By any means necessary.